Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and this week's thought-provoking conversations considering what non-Americans think about the US currently. If you have any thoughts about our topic discussion this week, do email me, ruth@itsaquestionofbalance.com. My next conversation is with expat, internationally best-selling and award-winning British author Michael Marshall Smith, who currently resides in Santa Cruz, California. I thought it would be interesting to get his outsider perspective, being British but living in the US. A highly talented and original writer for over 20 years, he's known in particular for The Straw Men, which he's currently adapting for TV. His supernatural thriller, The Intruders, was made into a dramatic TV series starring Myra Sorvino, Millie Bobby Brown and John Sim. His latest book, Hannah Green and Her Unfeasibly Mundane Existence, has just come out in paperback in the UK and will be coming out in the US in November. He's also known for ranting like a moron on Twitter. His words, not mine. Believe me, no one is farther from a moron than the witty and intelligent Michael Marshall Smith. But it is true to say he's very active on Twitter. You can check him out at MMS, which is E-M-E-M-E-S-S. And more information on him can be found at michaelmarshallsmith.com. So let's hear my conversation with Michael. So thanks again, Mike, for making the time to talk in your busy writing schedule. You're working on a new book, right?
Yep, just starting a new book right now.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you, making time to do this. So you moved to America how many years ago?
We've been here 6 years now.
Okay. So before you came here, you know, what was your view of America when you thought of America? What was the first thing that came to mind for you?
Well, I guess I had a reasonably good idea of what America was like because I was born in England, but I spent the first 7 years living here and then traveled around a little bit. And during my teens, my parents would bring us back here pretty often. So I had a reasonably good idea of what America was like, although a kind of dated one because I sort of had a lot of memories from the 70s and early 80s. And then there was a couple of decades where it was just occasional trips. So I think I had a sense, but maybe some of what I was sort of associating with it was sort of childhood times and childhood feelings rather than what the sort of contemporary reality was.
Right. So a lot of positive feelings. So what kind of, you know, things did you think about America?
Well, I think, and again, you know, a lot of English people of our generation, we saw a lot of America on the media, and so we saw quite a lot of sort of two-dimensional representations and so on. So you were aware of certain types of coolness or certain types of cultural things that all seem to be coming from America. And I think for a long time there was almost a feeling of catch-up because, you know, if you remember back, you know, when we were in our teens, you know, movies would come out here a year ahead of them coming out or 6 months ahead of. So there was always that feeling that it was slightly sort of provincial, I think. And, you know, moving to America was a sort of, okay, this is where it's all happening. It had that sort of atmosphere of particularly cultural films, movie, TV, music to a degree, although English music's always been very strong, that just that sense that this is where it's happening, you know.
And to some extent, that's very good PR on the part of America because a lot of things are not ahead of other places. Like, I always found it interesting that we had texting.
Yeah.
Far, you know, I don't know how long, but maybe even years before America had texting, you know, and also like digital rather than analog phones.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that technical stuff, I mean, partly because of the problems of sort of scaling in here, but stuff, the take up, and I think this is still the case to a degree, that the take up of certain types of technology and so on has always been far more rapid and fleet of foot in Europe than it has here. And I think something you possibly actually have to live here or spend a certain amount of time here to appreciate is that it's much less homogenous than it appears from the outside. Mm. And that with your smaller European countries, there's still a lot of variety between, for example, London and the north of England. And here that's magnified, you know, a hundredfold. The difference between the bits on the edge, the New Yorks, the San Francisco, Los Angeles, compared to what it's like in the Midwest or in Nevada or Florida, these are huge, huge differences. And so this somewhat monolithic culture that you see from the outside, once you get here, you realize that just doesn't really exist. And I think that's something that we've really seen starting to manifest itself in the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I think also a lot of what people from the outside think perhaps of America, particularly because of the media aspect that you mentioned, is very much centered around the West Coast or the East Coast.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, and to a degree, there's a certain sort of commonality between cities like New York, Paris, London. They have quite a similar feel. But a lot of the country is actually very, very different to that. And I think maybe now that's you're seeing more of that in fiction and media and TV and movies than you did in the sort of 60s and 70s. But it's certainly different from the way that it would appear from the outside.
So America being great has become a prominent theme in the last year. Have you ever, or do you think of America as being great, or is that more how a country would think of itself? And I mean, what even constitutes great?
Well, I mean, I think the whole great thing is it's being misused at the moment is a meaningless thing. I mean, I think America's always had a very bullish, boosterish sort of picture of itself, which is not at all surprising because a lot of the country was formed that way. It is still a relatively young country. And that's what people do. You know, in some ways it has that slightly sort of not teenager. I'm not saying anything unpleasant about the country here. I love the country. I live here. But that kind of early 20s self-defining, I'm all about this. This is what we are. This is, you know, and I think America's always had that sense of confidence in itself, pride in itself, and almost sort of ability and a desire to self-mythologize, to tell stories about itself, to see it as something larger than life. And, you know, I said confidence first, but I think one of the things that you've seen happen in the last 20, 30 years from things like the Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, I think was a big thing, the confusion of the 60s and 70s and to a degree 80s, is that that confidence finally has faltered a little bit. And that initial drive of, yeah, it's all great, it's all fantastic, we're all on the same track, as will happen in any individual life and certainly in any sort of cultural life, it starts to get muddier and more complicated than that. And I think one of the things that's happened and one of the things that helped propel the current president to his position is cannily realizing that there is this slight sort of, I don't know, are we what we thought we were? Are we what our parents told us that we were? And that sort of just coming up with a simple thing, let's make it great again. It feels positive. It feels like it's regaining something that, personally, I don't think was ever lost.
No. I mean, with that analogy of thinking of the country as young and either adolescent or sort of early 20s, I mean, that period of life, there is a kind of almost required self-obsession as you try to define yourself. And I think, you know, that is one of the reasons that has led to the assumption that everything here is bigger, better, greater, you know, generally speaking. Obviously, I'm making a very wide generalization. Whereas I think that there certainly isn't that much of an awareness that outside of America, people don't really perceive it in the same way, that people are a lot more critical, even of America. And obviously, well, I say obviously, during the Obama years, the perception of America, I think in Europe, certainly, I don't know about other parts of the world, really did change to a more positive view of America and perhaps seeing it in terms more like it seems to see itself. Is that something you also were aware of?
I think there's a degree of truth in it. I mean, you know, to be clear, you know, if you say that a country has a sort of, you know, teenager or 20s viewpoint, that sounds pejorative. And I think actually there's a balance to be struck, because I think in a number of European countries and England in particular, I think sometimes you can have the opposite of that, a rather kind of smug, tired, middle-aged, let's all do the same thing forever. And I think some of that sort of extraordinary vitality that America has and has always had is sadly lacking in some European countries. So it's not about one being better than the other. It's about them being different flavors. And I think the Obama years were very interesting because, you know, I remember when, you know, when he first came to power and everyone was incredibly excited about that, and there were Nobel Peace Prizes being lobbed around. And I remember thinking at the time, thinking, whoa.
Yeah.
This is just one guy and he's a decent guy. This is not, you know, this is not going to change everything. Let's not get overexcited. There is politics. There is a huge weight of history and the reality of getting things done. I mean, I think the reality was that Obama was a smart, classy guy who everybody In Europe looked at and thought, yeah, he seems like a good guy, we get this. And, you know, he was articulate, he presented things well, he was calm, there was no, you know, no drama, Obama. He was the kind of, I don't think it was just Europe, and I think there were a lot of people in this country as well who just thought, oh, okay, here we go. This is the kind of liberal, intelligent consensus that we hoped would start ruling the world, and here is just a particularly sort of charismatic example of it. And so I think that's one of the... And there are examples happening in Europe over the last couple of years as well, that sort of feeling of, okay, we're on the right track, we're heading where we want to go, and then for the sudden volte-face that we've seen in the last couple of years to happen here, I think it's been very shocking for some people.
I mean, I suppose there has always seemed to be more of a divide here between left and right, certainly to me anyway, than in Britain. I'm not saying there isn't, you know, left and right, but it just seems so stark here and so equally weighted, you know, that you just sort of feel where is the middle ground going to be found? And I think, I guess, to people who, as you were saying, wanted more of that kind of approach that Obama had, maybe it felt like the middle ground was being gained. But from what we've seen in the last sort of couple of years, obviously for some people, it actually had the quite the reverse effect.
I think it did have exactly the opposite effect. I mean, I think you're right in the sense that in and, you know, England's the only other country I know well enough to sort of speak of, really. There's a kind of muddiness. You know, there's a left and there's a right division, and it's fairly clear which interests they look after. But it's all kind of grey. I mean, something like the National Health Service, for example, in England, the left believes strongly in it. The right, some of them believe kind of strongly in it, but think it should be done differently. It's muddy. Whereas here, very often on politics, religion, race, a lot of things, the divisions are far more rigid. And it's either sort of like, yes, there should be universal healthcare for everybody, or no, why the hell should I pay for da 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 da? That we must not have that. And I think the spread, in the same way, religion's another example. In England, nobody really cares. You know, you either go to church or you don't, or you kind of believe or you don't. Nobody cares. Here, it's a huge deal. You either believe strongly in a secular society or you are, particularly with religion in this country over the last 20, 30 years, it's becoming more and more evangelical, more and more sort of, you know, charismatic based. Yeah. And there's no middle ground. And I think... You know, in effect, neoliberals like the Clintons, like Obama, they almost put a veneer over the middle, and the middle was never actually there. And underneath that carapace, there were a lot of people who sincerely hated the fact that a black guy was president, and that there was a black first lady, and that was bubbling underneath like a sort of horrendous cauldron. And now we're seeing a lot of that sort of stripped bare because we have somebody in the White House who to whose advantage it is to keep stirring that pot. I think, you know, containment has been the secret of a lot of sort of presidents of both sides for the last three or four decades, but there's no containment at the moment. There's encouragement, and that's not good.
It's an interesting about the separation of state and religion. I always think it's ironic that, you know, here there is an actual inbuilt, you know, mechanism to separate them, and yet religion pervades politics and policy. Whereas in Britain, where you have the head of state, who's also the head of the Church of England, and that's sort of embedded in the whole sort of parliamentary, you know, sort of opening and all of that, it just doesn't come into politics. And people seem, I mean, with abortion, for instance, you know, there's people obviously who really don't believe in abortion, but people are just, well, it's a personal choice, you know, and it's not a political, the arena for that is not politics. It's your own personal ethics.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as you say, that there's a weird paradox there, which is that, you know, England has a state religion, but if there were to be a new prime minister who said, yeah, I'm kind of agnostic, no one would really care. I mean, there are a couple of newspapers that jump up and down for a weekend, but that would be it. Whereas here, despite the fact that we have, you know, a president who is one of the least Christian people I can imagine, he has to keep paying lip service. This is one of these things. And he's doing these very traditional things about paying lip service. And like that whole ridiculous, now you can say Merry Christmas thing again, you know, as if Happy Holidays was in some ways, you know, doing down the church. And he's, you know, he's paying a lot of lip service to the to religion. He's paying a huge lip service, particularly at the moment, to the military. He's doing these sort of weird things, these non-secular things. Yeah, it's strange times from that point of view.
I think there's, I'm forgetting the author right now, but there's a really good book called Getting to Yes, which is about diplomacy and well, it's sort of in all situations, but he's worked in diplomatic arenas, if I can't remember his name. But one of the things he states in that book is that very often what happens is that people take up their positions. So, you know, you've got one person's up on their hill, the other person's up on their hill. And if you're in your position, you can never get to yes. There's just no chance. You know, you have to come down into the kind of field area, you know, and then talk. And I think that's what we're not seeing. And I think from my perspective, it's sad because both sides seem to be doubling down on their positions rather than trying to, you know, find a middle ground.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, a lot of these things are being drawn into sort of battles that can never be won and conversations that can never be had. Mm-hmm. If you have a discussion with somebody about abortion and their fundamental position is that from the moment of conception, that is a human being and a child, and that quote, fact exceeds all other debate, then there's no debate that you can have there.
No.
If you believe that it is a universal human right to have health care, then you cannot have any debate with somebody who believes that it isn't.
No.
And the idea that there is, it's one of the reasons why, to be honest, I'm somewhat mistrustful of Bernie Sanders, because I think he is, I don't think he's a realistic prospect for a president for a start, but I think also it's pulling things to the extremes, and both extremes are dangerous, and there comes a point where they background and are round to the point where they're almost arguing from the same positions of non-rationality and sort of absolute belief that I don't think is going to get us anywhere very positive, to be honest.
No. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my guest, internationally best-selling and award-winning British author Michael Marshall-Smith. If you want more information on him, you can go to his website, Michael Marshall-Smith. He's also on Twitter at MMS, which is spelt E-M-E-M-E-S-S. And the book that I was speaking about, Getting to Yes, is by Roger Fisher and William Urey. It's very interesting book. So this is all part of my conversations this week, hopefully thought-provoking conversations, considering what non-Americans think about the US currently. And author Michael Marshall-Smith is obviously British, but he currently resides in Santa Cruz, California. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more of my conversation with Michael after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work, and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and this week's thought-provoking conversations considering what non-Americans think about the US currently. Obviously, there are very varied opinions on what Americans think of the US right now, whether it needs to be made great again, whether it still is great, whether it ever was great. What does great mean? And I thought it would be interesting to get some views of non-Americans about what they think of America currently. And if you just joined us, you might want to check out the podcast of this show on the show's website. It's aquestionofbalance.com if you go to the topics page, because earlier in the show, I had two very interesting guests from interviews that I did on the street in London. There was Mark from Italy and Jade from France. So if you want to hear those conversations, if you just joined us and missed them, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and go to the topics page to get the audio there at your leisure. And currently, I'm talking to internationally best-selling and award-winning expat British author Michael Marshall Smith, who currently resides in Santa Cruz, California, to get his outsider perspective of America, being British but living in the US. So let's hear some more of that conversation. Sort of cycling back to this idea of making America great again, you know, that this idea of there being a golden age in the past. I mean, do you think that there was a golden age? I mean, obviously, if there was, patently, it was only for a certain section of society.
But well, yeah, but it's the same. You know, golden ages are always retrospective to a degree. Mm. I mean, you could claim there was a golden age of the British Empire, but, you know, because when we went out and ruled half the world, but we were subjugating and enslaving huge numbers of people and killing people and stealing all their stuff. And so it was kind of great for the small proportion of English society that got the massive advantages for that. Yeah. But it wasn't for everybody else, not just around the world, but in the slums of Manchester or London or anywhere else. And exactly the same is true here. There is, looking back, there would be certain gilded periods, but not for everybody, not for very long. It's like, you know, I think societies and cultures and nationalities are very like personal lives in the sense that you can always look back and say, oh, that year was fantastic, that summer was fantastic. But there will have been the mornings where you had a hangover. There will be the mornings where it wasn't working, where you woke up feeling miserable for no reason. But only in retrospect was that a golden year. And I think there is now such fine-grained attention on everything, you know, particularly this last, I mean, you know, you've been here for this last 18 months. It feels like we're getting a month's worth of news every day.
Yes,
and it's getting so fine-grained that it's impossible to look back and sort of say, well, that was great, because every day there's this sort of jittery, febrile awareness of things that are happening. And so I think it'll be a long time before we can look back and make a judgment on what this era is actually like and where it's going to go.
Yeah, that's a good thought. What are your thoughts on celebrities going straight into political office and government with no experience? Obviously, that's something that's more common here, you know, with Reagan and Schwarzenegger. And
well, I think, I mean,
they both were governors, though, before.
I was gonna say, you know, there's a background here. I mean, this started a long time ago, and you could even see, probably not the first seeds, but certainly seeds in the way in which, you know, Kennedy was celebritized. Mm. Okay, he was a real politician from a politician's family, but there was still suddenly, because he was taken outside that realm. And as you point out, I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan, for all his faults, was a real politician. He spent a long time as a union leader. He spent a long time as governor of California. He had stopped being an actor and had become a politician.
Yes.
Trump is a whole different thing. Personally, I think what I hope one of the lessons that will have come from this period is that politics is a real job. Mm. It's very easy to hate politicians. It's very easy to be suspect of their motives. And very often, you're right. Nonetheless, it is a real job involving real expertise, real compassion, real dedication. And what we're seeing here is that just getting some guy in because he beat everybody else and because he may or may not have made a certain money in real estate is an absolute disaster. Mm. That brings no legislative experience. It brings no planning. It brings no understanding of diplomacy on either an international or a national or a local scale. Mm. It's, I mean, you know, my eyes roll to the point where they fall out of my head when people start saying, oh, well, Oprah. It's like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
Have you learned nothing? Yeah. Just because somebody can stand up and give admittedly great speech, just because a heart is almost certainly in the right place. Mm. Although let's look back. You know, Oprah's done some pretty zany things and encouraged some pretty weird, fantastical views of the world in the stuff that she's promoted.
Yeah.
You know, this whole sort of, oh, I forget what it's called, the miracle thing where you're supposed to wish for success and it'll just drop into your lap. She promoted that,
yeah.
The secret. This is just magical thinking.
Yeah.
And it is magical thinking to think that you get an Oprah. Yeah, she'll be less appalling than Donald Trump, but she's still not a politician. She still has no experience. She still doesn't have the deep contacts and the political muscle memory required to make these decisions and to deal with people in a meaningful way. I'd much prefer her to the train wreck that's going on at the moment, but no, I mean, I would love to think that this would be the thing that would make people think, okay, well, let's not do that again. But who knows, you know? I mean, he's not an isolated phenomena. He's something that represents the peak of something that's been building for decades in this country.
Mm.
And I'd love to believe it's the end of it, but we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Mm. Now, you are quite active on social media and have quite a presence there. Obviously, that has really played into Trump's maybe even becoming president, but certainly how he's running his presidency, that he's bypassing, you know, however you want to look at it, you know, the normal channels or his handlers, that he, you know, he is able to say whatever he wants, whenever he wants. Do you think that is going to change, you know, how leaders are perceived going forward, or do you think it's going to be contained in just this experience?
I don't know. I mean, Trump is such an outlier in terms of the fact that he is just prepared to behave in ways that you would not expect any other politician to behave.
Mm.
Ways that I personally think are objectionable, ways that I think do display, however, a kind of native cunning, which has got him to where he is. He has an eye for what will distract. He has an eye for what will get people roiled up. He has an eye for what will keep his base, you know, trotting dutifully after him. I don't know. I mean, social media is a weird thing. I mean, it's and one has seen this coming for a very, very long time, the way in which it enables people to speak their mind, even if that mind is largely empty. It enables people to interact with distant others in ways that are sometimes positive. I mean, I have acquaintances from around the world who I'd never met otherwise, and I'm learning things from them, and I'm, you know, making me laugh. They're showing me stuff I wouldn't have seen. This is all fantastic. On the other hand, there's also a way of using that where basically you just get to bash people at random because they're not there in the face to punch you back. And I think that opening up those doors of a kind of very conflictual, angry way of interacting with each other, which again we see in the way that Trump interacts with people, again, I think it's going to be a long time before we can see whether or not the benefits of that actually outweigh the clear costs that we're seeing at the moment.
Mm. And finally, what qualities do you look for in a world leader? And do you think they're different for the leader of America to other countries?
I think America is a unique country. I mean, all countries are unique, of course. All countries have their own character and history and so on. But I think because of its position of power, because of its position of wealth, because of its relatively short span under its current formation, then it is a, you know, obviously kind of comparators are unique, but there are super unique qualities to America. And I think in a way that does require a particular type of personality. you know, there's a lot of people hate on Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I'm not saying that she's the best politician in the world or the best person in the world, but I sometimes picture what it would have been like, how much calmer we'd be, how much the world would just be trogging on, how much more attention we'd be paying to other things that matter if we had... I think.
What qualities does she have that Bill would have created that?
Well, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, and so the fact that she actually gave a damn about those kind of things, that she cared about women's rights, that she cared about kids' rights, that she was on what I regard as being the right side of a lot of issues, like healthcare, abortion, the way in which she would deal with foreign countries, a safe pair of hands. I think sometimes what a country needs is a safe pair of hands, more than somebody who's going to go out there and kick down doors in the hope that there'll be something good behind one of them.
Yeah.
But I don't know, in some ways, I think one has to take a slightly fatalistic view of this and say, you know, it's not just America. Weird things happening all around.
Yeah.
England, I sat with a beer and listened to the Brexit results as they rolled in, and I ended up drinking beer until the small hours because I just could not believe that that had happened.
Yeah.
And when you see what's happening to a degree in France, bits of Europe, Poland, we're going through one of those weird cyclic phases, which is why, in a way, I think the strong, characterful, safe pairs of hands like Angela Merkel or some like, I think, Clinton would have done a perfectly good job. But, you know, just to hold the ship steady through these very sort of turbulent seas, rather than somebody who is...
And somebody who's willing, perhaps, to tolerate incremental change rather than feeling, like you said, that doors have to be knocked down, broken through.
Yeah.
Because especially, I think, in a country like America, where you have so much division, but, you know, you have to govern with consensus, then you are, you know, going to have, unfortunately, that is what, you know, way change is going to really realistically happen. It is incrementally and more slowly than perhaps we all would wish on either side.
That's what politicians understand. I mean, it's, you know, Trump, for example, is so happy about deregulating everything. So these regulations, of course, there are too many of them. On the other hand, they govern whether or not you get food poisoning. They govern whether or not you get run down. They govern, these are things that have incrementally come. And yes, maybe you don't need 10% of them, but they're still important in the same way that it's important that state office jobs are filled with people who are experienced, because you can't just barge in and think you know what to do. There's a great deal of experience and history and knowledge. And again, referring back to Obama, even though he was a young guy and, you know, not faultless, made some errors, you got that sense that at least he was thinking about it from a certain point of view rather than having a kind of reptilian knee-jerk reaction. Because there are a lot of other leaders around the world, some of whom have missiles, who also have that kind of thing. And all it takes, you know, I don't want to be alarmist, but it doesn't take a lot.
No.
And so, yeah, I would personally much prefer to see somebody who was coming to the table saying, yeah, America's great, or it is what it is. Let's keep on getting a little bit better. Let's keep on persisting. Time will pass. Lives will happen. There's no magic solution. There's no magic upgrade here.
No.
It's hard work being a country, just like it's hard work being a person. You just have to keep on keeping on.
Well, thanks, Mike. Good talking to you, as always.
Nice to talk to you.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. And thanks again there to internationally best-selling and award-winning British author Michael Marshall Smith, who currently lives in Santa Cruz, California. More information on him can be found at michaelmarshallsmith.com. And on Twitter, you can check him out at MMS, E-M-E-M-E-S-S. And then in America, look out for his new book, Hannah Green and Her Unfeasibly Mundane Existence, coming out in November. And if you're in the UK, then it just came out in paperback there. So you will be able to experience it already. Remember that you can go to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, to find past shows. If you liked this show, then you can go to the topics page and find the podcast there. Thanks for listening. Join me again next time.